From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week, we're broadcasting from the Georgia Public Broadcasting Studios in Atlanta, Georgia.
All those in favor signify by saying aye. All those opposed, no. Any other chair, the ayes have it. The resolution's adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
Go ahead.
I don't know. It's very, I don't.
Who are we going to see prime time? Sandra Fluck?
Yeah.
Sandra Fluck? Are you kidding me?
This weekend, we're right in the middle between the two political parties' conventions. Next week, State of Belief Radio will be at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. As I said to you last week, we wanted to go to the Republican convention, but we couldn't get credentials. I want to make sure that you visit us frequently at stateofbelief.com next week, where we'll be posting daily reports and interviews. Our updates will include expert commentary from George Washington University's Greg LaBelle, a veteran of several presidential campaigns. Remember, go to www.stateofbelief.com. And on today's show, Kevin Ekstrom, editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, will be able to talk with us about the headlines being made during this convention season in the realms of religion, politics, and government.
There's been plenty of prayer about Isaac in the last few days.
We have had lots and lots of people praying around the clock that it would move, and it has really moved out of the way for us, and we appreciate God doing that and moving it for us.
What happens when nothing is sacred? Even the actual sacred is not sacred. As politics wraps its slimy arms around the language of faith and values, what suffers more, democracy or religion? We'll explore that very timely question with Duke University Associate Professor of Theological Ethics, Luke Bretherton. Don't miss that interview. But first,
the real issue is not a single statement of a person. When that happens, we have to deal with it. But the way to deal with it is not to shoot our own soldier laying on the battlefield.
As much as some of the social issues that former presidential candidate Pat Buchanan shouted about from the podium at the 1992 Republican convention seemed to come from the party's fringe at that time, in the intervening decades, they've established themselves in the mainstream of the GOP's rhetoric. And inevitably, they are promoted and sustained by the language of religion, both within and beyond the party's formal leadership. When Mitt Romney entered the current presidential race, leading voices within the Republican Party denounced him as not Christian. They even called him a member of a cult. But as his nomination began to look inevitable, those same voices found a way to approve of his religious background. It's important to note that this did not involve looking beyond Romney's faith, something I would have been much more comfortable with, but virtually to redefine him as an evangelical for practical purposes, to redefine his religious background and then double down on how that now helped make him qualified to lead. Well, the same magic happened after Missouri Representative Todd Akin made his extraordinary statement regarding rape and conception. Need I even remind you that Akin said that if a woman was raped legitimately, whatever that means, then she wouldn't get pregnant because women raped legitimately had biological forces that kept her from being pregnant. Some prominent leaders, like former presidential candidate and Baptist Mike Huckabee, did not distance themselves from Akin's remarks, but instead embraced them. And it all brings to mind the old saying, he may be a fool, but he's our fool. Have we reached yet another new low in win-at-all-cost electioneering? And what does it do to religion when dogmas are seemingly rewritten to match the words of a favored political candidate? Look, I have been wanting to talk about this with a fellow Baptist. In fact, I've been wanting to talk about it with a fellow woman who is a Baptist, because this denomination seems particularly vulnerable to this kind of manipulation in recent years. So, joining me now is Susie Painter, director of the Texas Baptist Human Life Commission and a respected voice not only in Baptist life but beyond on these issues. Susie, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
When you heard Todd Akin's remark, what did you think?
It was shock. It was total shock. My first thought was, I didn't hear that right. That couldn't possibly be what he said. Uh-huh. My second take on it, after I realized, no, he really meant what he said and he was defending what he said, is that we've had a new low of the religious community mm-hmm. not even giving credibility to the most basic human science of reproduction. Mm-hmm. I was offended as a woman. I was offended as a Christian. And I thought, my gosh, you know, will there be no barriers to what people will say mm-hmm. in order to manipulate an election?
Mm-hmm. What did you think when you heard or read that Mike Huckabee had aligned himself with Todd Akin's remarks and tried to build a Baptist base of support for them?
The idea of abortion-based rhetoric in our politics for so many years, it made me think, have we just talked about this issue so endlessly mm-hmm. that we have nothing left to say, mm-hmm. only to go to a more extreme and more extreme position to try to diminish the impact and the horror and the tragedy of rape? Mm-hmm. I was disappointed in Mike Huckabee because I have understood his positions many times as a thoughtful position, mm-hmm. a conservative position, but a very thoughtful position. Mm-hmm. And I was very surprised. And then I thought, well, is he just hoodwinked by this same pseudoscience? And if so, why not denounce it today?
Yeah. Susie, isn't it a kind of relativism that first and foremost serves a political purpose and tries to do that by being framed in a religious context?
Yeah, and here's the paradox in that, is that so many times the preliminary rhetoric is we have the absolute values. Mm-hmm. Here are the real truths. And then the articulation of something like this is the exact opposite. It's a relativistic statement. This, to me, is deception. Mm-hmm. It does discredit to the gospel, to the Christian community, to the greater good of mankind to say that we are going to just pick up the toolbox of deception mm-hmm. In the name of this political party. And the reason I say that is I see so many churches and religious groups being used. It's like their Rolodex is for sale.
Right. Right.
You know, and I'll deliver to you this many names. And so in order to be favored by the purchaser of that Rolodex, mm-hmm. it's like we'll say anything. And the deception in the name of religion, you know, is among the greatest betrayals.
Yeah. What about the radical changes that we've seen regarding attitudes toward Mormonism in terms of Mitt Romney's being a palatable candidate for evangelical Christians? And then again, I mean, my preference would be that these questions not enter the political debate at all, that we just talk about, is he a good candidate for president? But since they are in the debate, do you see this is a case where the candidate failed the basic litmus test of the evangelical community, and then they just rewrote the test?
Absolutely. And here's a similar paradox, a similar irony to it, which is that at the same time that they have turned from even having an articulate analysis of Mormonism and the differences between evangelical Christianity and Mormonism, and there are several points to be discussed along that line, but instead of even going down that road, it's just a wholesale discount of the differences. As I believe as Mike Huckabee said in his speech last night, well, it's what he's going to do for the country. It's not his religion, which is, again, the irony is that these groups are often formed and built on their godly principles, on their scriptural foundations, and so to dismiss that wholesale, on one hand. Secondly, in the most vehement and destructive ways, you have Representative Gohmert and others coming, and Michelle Bachmann coming against Muslims that are in positions of responsibility in the government, impugning their religious nature and context and culture by association, you know, totally unfounded, accusing them of radical affiliations. And so it's like they're discounting religious difference on one hand, and then but escalating the verbal violence on the other hand.
Yeah, yeah.
Same voices, same voices.
Is there anything in our historic Baptist tradition as Christians that gives credence to or affirmation for the kind of behavior we saw in Huckabee's embrace of this terrible comment about rape, or the nimbleness with which we saw Baptist pastors move from a condemnation of a candidate to an affirmation of a candidate on the basis of that candidate's political identity?
Well, I'll tell you what a friend of mine says. Be careful of the beans. The beans, I said. Yes, the human beans, he said.
I say.
I think, you know, our fallibility as human beings when faced with power, it is a litmus test of our convictions. Are you going to stand with your convictions when faced with the temptation, the sweet taste of powerful notoriety?
Mm.
Our tradition, many traditions, the tradition of integrity, says this is the test. Sadly, we don't rehearse for it very well.
Yeah.
And so when pastors, when leaders are met with the bright lights of fame and the pandering of powerful people, it's hard to reach down and keep that touch point of conviction and constancy. And so when I see this wavering from one pole to another, from one place to another, it's not that I might not even share many, many views of the person who's speaking. But the sadness to me is the lack of consistency in the face of power. And the witness of Christ in the face of power was consistency. And I think that's what the sad context for the Christian community right now is, that that story will be written, that, oh no, they couldn't be consistent. They had to wave all around the place to pander to someone else.
Susie, why don't you give our listeners your website so they can check you out and may find some help in what your information you're providing.
Sure. It's texasbaptist.org/CLC. That stands for the Christian Life Commission. Or you can just Google Texas Baptist and go to the Christian Life Commission. That's our website. We have several pages on public policy and several pages on keeping your church out of court, including IRS rules of what churches can and can't do, and some resources as well about churches and politics.
Susie Painter is the director of the Texas Baptist Human Life Commission. She also heads the Office of Advocacy and Care. Susie, I've been wanting to talk with you, and I really appreciate you joining us today and sharing your insights on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton.
We've got to take a short break now, but coming right up, Kevin Ekstrom. Remember him? Always good. Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief, smart man. He'll be here in just a moment. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. For over 75 years, Religion News Service has been an invaluable resource for objective coverage of religion and its role in our culture and politics. And as we listen to the language of faith emanate from political podiums, as well as political rhetoric work its way into words spoken from the pulpit, I'd like to take a look at this national convention season as it has gone up to this point with Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Kevin Ekstrom. Kevin, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's always good to be here.
We're taping this conversation in advance of the big event at the Republican National Convention, so unfortunately we can't discuss Mitt Romney's acceptance speech yet. But from what we've seen so far in Tampa, how would you characterize the pervasiveness of religious language in the rhetoric this year?
I'd call it cagey, maybe. Nobody is using the M word, Mormon, and I think that's probably for fairly specific and deliberate reasons. But what I've noticed is that people are talking about Romney in a way that portrays him as a very faithful person, mm-hmm. as a church-going man, a family man. And I was struck by where both Paul Ryan and Mike Huckabee made a point of saying, Mitt Romney and I go to different churches, but he goes to church, bottom line. And so there is this attempt to portray him as a devout religious person, but not a devout religious Mormon, necessarily. And that's kind of interesting.
Would you say that's different from the way religious language has been used in the past?
If we stick with Republican circles.
For now, let's do that.
The last time that faith really entered the conversation was with George W. Bush, who is a born-again evangelical, and he would talk in sort of born-again evangelical language. He would talk about, Jesus as his savior and sort of encountering him on the beach with Billy Graham. He was very sort of specific and direct about it, and there was none of this sort of walking on eggshells when it came to talking about his religious faith. So to that degree, it's different, but this is not an election where religion or religious issues are playing a huge role like they may have in the past. This is a pocketbook election, and people are concerned about jobs and the economy, and that's what they're stressing. But what they're doing with Mitt Romney especially is, he's in many ways kind of a blank slate to a lot of people. He's kind of mysterious. They don't really know who he is. I mean, they know that he's got a big family and that he's got a lot of money and that he's a Republican, but beyond that, it's kind of an empty sketch, and so they're trying to fill it in, but using sort of generic language that, is actually a little different for Republicans. They've always been very out front about religious rhetoric, and this year they're being a little bit more generic.
I'll talk some more with Kevin Ekstrom right after this break, and later in the show, Duke University Associate Professor of Theological Ethics, Luke Bretherton. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. This free State of Belief Radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Well, Kevin, as editor-in-chief of Religion News Service, what are the themes that you see emerging actually from both political parties now in your coverage? And which of those themes do you see as most related to people's religious interests?
Well, I think there's a fascinating debate this year, and we haven't had this before, about what it means to be Catholic or what it means to be a Catholic politician. And the last time that this came up was really with John Kerry back in 2004, where there were really questions of whether or not he's a good enough Catholic. Mm-hmm. Was he devout enough? Did he follow the church? Now we're having this really interesting debate between Joe Biden on the Democratic side and Paul Ryan on the Republican side about, well, what does it mean to be Catholic, period? And if you're a Ryan sort of Catholic, you're stressing what they call the life issues, abortion and gay marriage and stem cells, but especially abortion. If you're a Joe Biden Catholic, you're stressing the social justice teachings of the church about poverty and the economy and things like that. And the church is really caught in the middle, which is, in a way, exactly where they want to be, because the Catholic hierarchy has always said that, we don't fit into either political party, and no political party perfectly addresses all of our issues. And here we see it in very stark black and white between the two sides. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a fascinating debate over not only are you a good enough Catholic, but what kind of Catholic are you? And are you a nuns on the bus sort of Catholic, like Joe Biden would be? Or are you a March for Life anti-abortion Catholic like Paul Ryan would be? Mm-hmm.
I always like it. You specialize in coverage of religion, so that lets me ask you to evaluate the way mainstream media cover issues. How have they been doing this year?
I think they've been good. I think there's, like in the campaign itself, there's a lot of walking on eggshells on the Mormon question. Uh-huh. I've been actually fairly surprised at the amount of attention that's been paid to the fact that there are no Protestants on the Republican ticket, that's somehow indicative of some large shift or some large decline among Protestants. I don't really see it that way. It was really interesting to me that Mike Huckabee, speaking to the convention on Wednesday night, called President Obama the only, quote-unquote, self-professed evangelical in the race. I've never once heard President Obama call himself an evangelical, and he probably, when asked, I would think he would say, no, I'm not. But there's this attempt to kind of label people and to try to divine importance in those labels, and I think it only gets you so far.
Yeah. Catholic Archbishop Timothy Dolan is the faith leader invited to deliver the closing prayer at both national conventions this year. In his role as head of the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, he's been deeply involved in political confrontations with the Obama administration. So how do you see this one?
I think he sort of put himself into a box on this one when he accepted the Republicans' invitation without ever either exploring the idea of also going to the Democrats or asking to go to the Democrats. What this did before he agreed to go to both, but when he had just agreed to go to the Republicans, it really did feed into this image and this line that the bishops and the Catholic hierarchy are really just in lockstep with the Republican Party.
Right.
And that was not where the church wants to be. And even, for as vociferous as he is on his disagreements with the Obama administration, Colonel Dolan is smart enough to know that he doesn't want to be seen as, in the pocket of one party over the other. So I think, in a way, he almost had no choice but to try to also do the Democrats. And I think the Democrats, in a way, were sort of pressured into trying to get him just to save their own face. They were under pressure to show that they would want to have him, whether or not he wanted to come, but that the invitation was there, because they also don't want to be portrayed as being against the Catholic Church or the Catholic hierarchy. So I think in the end, the fact that he's doing both is probably the smarter move and perhaps diffuses some of the tension around it. Mm-hmm. But it seems like, anyway, that he accepted the one invitation without totally thinking through, well, what do I need to also go to the other one as well?
Yeah. Kevin, what are you going to be watching for at the Democratic National Convention?
You know, this campaign, the 2012 campaign, has been fairly silent on the faith issue and religious outreach on the Democratic side. They're doing it, but they're doing it in a very muted kind of way, especially compared to their massive outreach that they had in 2008. So I will be listening to see, if that even comes up at all. So far, it hasn't. But also, what do they do with the Catholic issue and this fight that they have with the Catholic bishops? How do they walk that line between standing up for what they see as, reproductive rights and access to women's health versus not wanting to be seen as pitting themselves against the largest church in the country?
Yeah.
If I had to guess, they're probably going to just avoid it altogether.
As far as you know, is our preoccupation with politics these days going to cause us to miss any significant religion story that you want people to know about?
Well, I think, the sort of the unspoken story in all of this, the thing that's not really getting attention is we're talking about dollars and budgets and debt, and we throw out terms of trillions of dollars without ever really stopping to think, okay, well, what does that mean in real terms? What does that mean for the poor? What does it mean for people on welfare or people on Medicaid or whatever? And there's this large macro discussion about federal spending without sort of the micro conversation about what that means in real dollars to real people. And that's an issue that religious groups of all stripes care a tremendous amount about, and we haven't really seen that from either side.
Kevin Ekstrom is editor-in-chief of Religion News Service. You can find terrific secular coverage of religion's role in our world at religionnews.com. Kevin, we missed you while you were gone. I'm glad you're back, and I thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Absolutely. Glad to be back.
You know, we would have liked to bring State of Belief to the Republican National Convention, but credentials were unavailable. However, we will be able to attend the Democratic National Convention with credentials, and I'd like you to be sure and visit with us often at stateofbelief.com all week long. We're going to have daily updates and interviews from Charlotte. I know you will enjoy them if you enjoy this show. Don't forget us next week. We won't be forgetting you. That's stateofbelief.com. Still to come on this week's show, Duke University Associate Professor of Theological Ethics Luke Bretherton on what happens when everything becomes political fodder. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. We're all values voters now. It's easy to reach that conclusion, at least, when political campaigns seem increasingly built on appealing to constituents' values in morals and religious terms. But now here's a question. Does that really elevate the political discourse, or does it draw the language of faith and ethics into the morass of electioneering? Well, here to talk about that is Duke University Associate Professor of Theological Ethics, Luke Bretherton. Dr. Bretherton, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much indeed.
When you look at some of the grand ethical themes being put in the service of gaining an uptick in the polls of one of or two-tenths of a point, do you see a disconnect there?
I don't tend to. I tend to take a little bit of a kind of historical perspective. One of the more surprising things, I think, about this current debate is if you wind it back to the 60s, the new left in America mm-hmm. gave a very profound critique of the lack of values-based language and discourse in politics and the kind of emphasis on very utilitarian and kind of dry numbers-based debates as driving politics. And they very much called for a kind of language that would reinvigorate and re-engage American people. And in many ways, what we can see is the coming to fruition, ironically enough, of a call from the new left mm-hmm. by the new right. And the kind of debates we see around things like sexuality and abortion and things like that, which do energize voters. So the issue for me is not that we shouldn't have debate issues that have a strong values focus, if you like, mm-hmm. To them in public. The question is the tenor and tone by which we do it. And I think often there's this, do we have values in political discourse or not? It's kind of false dichotomy. We should debate these things. These are really important questions. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do we do it and in what tone and tenor do we go about it?
What do you see and what do you hear when every campaign issue is promoted in the language of faith? I mean, does it, as I said in the introduction, does it primarily elevate the discourse or does it cheapen it?
I think one of the problems with saying it doesn't elevate it is that basically it's used and deployed in a way in order to kind of polarize and personalize mm-hmm. so that it creates this divide, either you're with us or against it, and right. it kind of simplifies the issues and refuses the possibility of common ground and a common life. But there was a wonderful quote, I think, by the governor of Florida recently with Hurricane Isaac coming in about, he said, hurricanes are a bipartisan issue. But we could extend that. There's lots of issues that are about the common life that we have together. The way in which a lot of the kind of values-based rhetoric and framing in terms in religious discourse or otherwise is used in very divisive terms. But it might. We could equally see that used as ways of talking about common life, about things we all hold in common or things that are important for us to sustain a common life in which each of our individual flourishing depends. So it's, again, I just kind of want to refuse this idea of either we've got to have values rhetoric or got to completely expunge it from public discourse. I just think these are problematic false dichotomies.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I can't help remember Pat Robertson, for example, did not agree with the governor of Florida. He thought that tornadoes and hurricanes were tools of God to call people back to righteousness. And I think that's a little divisive also. But are there debates right now going on that you wish were less couched in religious language, or is that just a natural expression of what ultimately matters to a majority of the voters?
I think I would take the opposite view. I would take the view that I think there are issues which should be more couched in religious terms, primarily around economic issues. Everyone's very uncomfortable about using the language of usury. Mm-hmm. Yet that's a big bit of the financial crisis we're trying to work through. And if you look at foreclosure crises and things like that, it's about the power of debt over individuals and over families and the destruction of family lives and communities and kind of excessive interest rate charges and things like that. Well, that's a very religious language of usury, and people have used as a contrary language of jubilee. Now, these are religious terms with rich religious histories, not unproblematic. There's a great joke I sometimes use in class that the only thing that really divides conservatives and liberals over their use of scripture is which bits they read literally. In a democracy, we need to know what people really think and where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And be able to learn to talk across often very different ways of framing things. And that's part of the art of building a common life, is working across those kinds of differences. Now, I can't do that if everyone's pretending to be nice New York theater-going liberals, because I'm not really meeting them. Uh-huh. So the question is, how do we learn to deal with difference in relationship mm-hmm. And live at the borders? Borders are where we actually meet others, meet real points of difference, but learn that borders aren't necessarily threatening places where we have to set up ramparts and defenses and big chain link fences. They can be places of encounter.
Yes.
The problem is that at the moment we only see them through the grid of a chain link fence. We don't see the other as that border is a point of exchange and trade and kind of mutual learning.
Religion, and I'll say especially religion in the South, has no trouble using religious language about sexuality and what are called, I suppose, matters of personal morality. But when you get into economics, you've started meddling in the basics of life.
Well, I think that's a very, very good point. It's a very good point. But it kind of illustrates the issue that where is religious language is being deployed in certain kinds of places and not in other kinds
exactly,
of places.
Exactly.
But I think there's a very crucial issue here is what I would say to those people who are very happy to use it in relation to issues of sexuality and gender and the like, and those who are very uncomfortable about seeing it in terms of economics, is that ironically, they are themselves marginalizing the place of religious language. They're saying, here is this realm called economics, which can be free from theological framing or religious framing and is kind of neutral and it just works by laws of nature, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And here is these other things which are highly contested and we have religious debates over. But that in itself is an act of self-marginalization.
If you had the opportunity to sit with the political advisors of both major candidates for the presidency, what would you say to them in terms of what you would like to hear from the candidates, what you'd like to hear more of than you're hearing, and what you'd like to hear less of than what you're hearing?
I certainly would like to hear less of this kind of personalizing and polarizing talk, which refuses the possibility of a common life. At the end of the day, we do all have to live together. Hurricanes do affect us all, whether they're economic hurricanes or weather hurricanes. So the upholding of the value and the moral endeavor, the moral place of political life, i.e., this is a moral exercise, politicians. I want to celebrate politicians, not denigrate them. Celebrate them as people involved in a moral exercise of this process of negotiating a common life around things that are very important. At the same time, I do think issues both around poverty and a serious debate around issues of life, both a consistent theme of life, including things like capital punishment, as well as the whole question of the levels of numbers of people being incarcerated in America, and how do we value life, both of the unborn and those who are in trouble who have done wrong. So I think the questions about life do need to be on the table. It just needs to be a broader perspective, and there will be differences of opinion, but it's an important debate to have. But that also needs to be accompanied by a very serious commitment to how do we get beyond a positioning of others as completely beyond the pale, as completely, you cannot talk to these people, and if you talk to these people, that's to be compromised. No, that is to make politics untenable and therefore immoral. It suddenly is to overpaint politics as an inherently bad exercise. So you have people talking about, my role is to shrink government down into size so I can flush it down the toilet. Well, that is to say politics is not a worthwhile activity. Mm-hmm. So why would you give your life to that? I want to say that these are important tasks that involve moral questions, and it's right and a good vocation, but it does take a commitment to a common life first. And then we have very vehemently held differences about how we go about building that common life. But it seems to me we put the differences first and the common life comes second. I just think the equation's wrong.
I've been speaking with Luke Bretherton, Associate Professor of Theological Ethics at Duke University and Senior Fellow at the Kennan Institute of Ethics. Dr. Bretherton writes widely on religion and politics, as he well should. Thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, Dr. Bretherton.
A delight to be with you, and thank you for the opportunity.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com. To find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. then you can listen to us anywhere, anytime. You can stay in touch with us all next week. Share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. We like social media. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. We always want to encourage you to tell other people about the show and encourage them to listen. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week as we bring you daily updates from the Democratic National Convention. We'll bring you more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.